Welcome to the Common Sense Spirituality Show, the show that takes the mystery out of spirituality with your host, David Gagan, engineer, science director, scholarly researcher of life's mysteries, and author of The Endless Journey.
Welcome to the Common Sense Spirituality Show. I'm host Dave Gagan, and this is the show where we talk about subjects which are critical to our happiness and spiritual evolution, but all too often, we don't think enough about them. Our goal is to break up complicated topics into small enough bits that we can integrate some aspects into our lifestyle. Please note that all the chat room questions will be answered in the chat room on next week's show, as well as posted on my website, which is davidgagan.com, hopefully within a day or so of the show. When you visit the site, you can ask additional questions, even about other shows. You can also listen to any previous show on iHeartRadio at iHeart.com, searching for either David Gagan or Common Sense Spirituality. We encourage and welcome your questions. Today's show is titled Depression. We all have good and bad days, but occasionally we can find ourselves in a situation where the bad days just keep coming day after day. After a while, we realize that we are living in a depressed state. And the questions are, how do we recognize that we have the problem? And if we do, how do we get out of it? Today's guest is Dr. Alex Korb, a neuroscientist who has studied the brain for over 15 years, starting with an undergraduate degree in neuroscience from Brown University. He received his PhD in neuroscience from UCLA, where he is currently a postdoctoral neuroscience researcher in the Department of Psychiatry. Dr. Korb is the author of The Upward Spiral, Using Neuroscience to Reverse the Course of Depression, One Small Change at a Time. Outside the lab, he is a scientific consultant for the biotech and pharmaceutical industries and is head coach of UCLA's Women's Ultimate Frisbee team. He has a wealth of experience in yoga and mindfulness, physical fitness, and even stand-up comedy. Dr. Alex Korb, welcome to the show, Alex.
Thanks for having me on. Great to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you. Okay, let's start out with what is depression?
It's definitely a complicated thing to answer. It's defined by a set of symptoms. That's how it's defined in the DSM for the Diagnostic Statistical Manual. Sorry, DSM-5 now. They came out with a new one. But I usually look at about what's going on in the brain. In the brain, it's what I would call a problem with, I'm going to get a little technical, frontal limbic communication, which means it's a problem with how the thinking and feeling and action circuits in the brain are communicating with each other. And what that means is that leads to a whole host of symptoms that people experience that goes so much beyond plain sadness, including problems with sleep, depressed mood, obviously, lack of energy, feelings of guilt, feelings that life isn't worth living, things that were enjoyable are no longer enjoyable, feelings of loneliness. And the list, unfortunately, goes on and on.
So you see it as more of a physical problem that shows up with emotional signs than it is most people think of it as an emotional issue. But, you know, do you see it more as a physical issue?
Well, as a neuroscientist, I mean, before I really understood the brain, I think I probably viewed it a little bit differently. But as I've gone through my neuroscience education and done all this research, I've started to realize how any mental or emotional side that you have is because of some activity in the brain. It's all being expressed through brain electrical and chemical activity. So while it might seem like there's this easy distinction to say, oh, that's psychological versus, oh, that's neurological or physical. Really, our thoughts and emotions are mediated by neurological processes. So there's not really, I don't really make that much of a distinction. And so it's just two different ways of looking at the same thing. And I think a lot of times it's very helpful, particularly for people with depression, to try and understand that it's a result of certain brain processes, because we experience ourselves as having, you know, all these thoughts and emotions. But since those come from the brain, if things are going wrong in depression and something feels really off, if you can recognize that, oh, it's just a problem, this part of my brain is just a little overactive, there's nothing wrong with me per se, just it's just this part of brain activity or these two regions are miscommunicating. And in the same way that we would understand, like, if your arm was broken, you would look at your arm and say, oh, my arm is broken. You wouldn't say, I am broken.
Right.
But a lot of times in depression, since we don't understand our brains, we don't have that same distance to recognize, oh, it's just a little part of you that is not quite functioning properly.
Yeah, you say that in your book, you say that when depression occurs, it isn't like something's broken. It's like something's out of tune.
Yeah. I think you said it better than I said it in my book. What happens so often, people come up to me and they say, so what's wrong with my brain? Like, I'm depressed, you know, what's wrong with me? And the language is so negative and judgmental. And it often comes from, because we don't understand, because the experience of having a brain is simply being conscious. You experience yourself as a complete whole. Whereas as a neuroscientist, we recognize, oh, different parts of the brain are contributing in different ways to different aspects of your personality and your experience. And so in depression, you just have certain circuits that are tuned a little high. I often use the example of a microphone and a speaker that are connected. If the microphone and the speaker or oriented in just a particular way, even just a little sound can lead to screeching feedback. But that's not to say that there's anything wrong with the microphone. There's nothing wrong with the speaker. Both are working exactly as they're supposed to. And it's just a problem with the dynamic interaction of the circuits.
Right, and it's not working together like they should, but they're working.
Exactly. Your brain is full of all these dynamic interacting circuits that are contributing to decision-making and actions and planning. And sometimes it's not that you have anything wrong with your brain. You just need to figure out how to turn down the volume a tiny bit on that speaker or reorient the microphone just a little bit. You don't need to rewire the whole system. It's sometimes just these small little changes are enough to break up the dynamics of that communication that's causing the problem.
Can anyone and everyone get out of depression?
Everyone can do things that would contribute to them improving in their depression. So that's one of the reasons why the subtitle of the book I have is Changing the Course of Depression, because there are dozens of different life changes that you can make that have measurable effects on the chemistry and regions that are important in depression. And for any given individual, making a bunch of small little life changes, it might not be enough to push you past the threshold where a doctor would say, okay, you're no longer depressed. but it would certainly improve your situation better than if you hadn't done those things. For a lot of people, I mean, some people will, their depression will just get better entirely by taking antidepressant medication. Whereas other people, antidepressant medication isn't going to work for them, and they need to make a series of life changes or engage in psychotherapy or do some neuromodulation technique. Whereas a lot of, most people with depression, some combination of that is going to get them better. Now, for any given individual, it's, we don't know if we can necessarily get you completely better, because everyone's brain is unique, but we can certainly work to make your situation much improved.
Yeah. Your book is, you titled your book, The Upward Spiral, mm-hmm. Having reverse it. That implies that impression, that depression was a downward spiral.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is that, do we get into it a little bit at a time and then all of a sudden find ourselves trapped in this thing?
Yeah. The problem is, I think that some people's brains are just more susceptible to depression. Just like going back to that circuit and speaker analogy, some people's brains, the microphone is right on the edge of pointing right at that speaker, and the speaker is just at the, almost at that max volume, so it's just almost itching to start running away in that screeching feedback. And sometimes a serious life event is a big stimulus in your life that pushes you over. It's a big stressor, like divorce or losing your job or someone important to you dies. And these huge life events can change the chemistry and activity in key brain regions, and that takes a somewhat susceptible individual and pushes them over the edge. But other times, it's just a series of smaller steps. For example, you just have a thought. It's a Friday night, and your friend invited you to a party, but you just have a fleeting thought like, oh, it's not going to be that fun. And you listen to that thought, and so you don't go to the party. And then that weekend, because you didn't really socialize with anyone and you haven't really had any activity, maybe you start feeling a little bit down and isolated. And by the end of the weekend, you're not really doing anything. You've just sat at home, and you feel lonely and sad. And that's not what depression is, but I think that's sort of what the edge of depression starts like. And if your brain is susceptible to falling further, well, then you can continue spiraling further. And particularly if you throw in other factors like chronic pain or insomnia or an alcohol or drug problem or some other life stressor, then that can continue to push you downward in that spiral.
Now in your book, you gave a list of, I think it was like 9 items, and mm-hmm. you said, If you suffer from 5 of those, you probably are depressed. Mm-hmm. Why don't you mentioned a couple of them earlier, but why don't we just go through those quickly and say, you know, and so just so the listeners know what you're talking about.
Oh yeah, sure. That's the funny thing is a lot of times, like when I was writing my book, I was focusing so much on the neural aspects of depression, what this brain region is doing, or how you can, your life changes can boost serotonin activity and things like that. And my wife was like, maybe you should just have a section where you just describe the symptoms of depression and and so that people can sort of see if they have it.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. Your wife was absolutely right.
Yes. I know sometimes when you're in the science, you get a little too deep in it. Depression, the collection of symptoms, I can go through them in a second, but essentially if you have five or more of them nearly every day for at least a couple weeks, then you can be diagnosed with depression. So it's not just a something that happens for 1 or 2 days. It has to be an extended period of time. And while a lot of your listeners might think that they have some or a lot of these symptoms, you have to be careful about self-diagnosis. But if you're concerned that you might have depression, then you should go see a doctor or a therapist or a psychiatrist, because really only a professional can diagnose you and they can start getting you help. But the symptoms include having a depressed mood, which such as feeling sad, but often it's just feeling empty all the time, like an emptiness where emotion should be. You can have decreased interest or pleasure in a lot of activities. A lot of times it involves either significant weight gain or significant weight loss. That can be another sign. Problems around sleep, either difficulty falling asleep or difficulty staying asleep, or sometimes it's even you feel like you want to sleep all the time. You can have oftentimes just like a physical slowness, everything you're doing is just slowed down. But interestingly, in some people, it's like a restlessness and fidgetiness. So a lot of things present different ways in different people that show the underlying depression. Internally, you can often feel like you have no energy, like you get fatigued really easily. You have a lot of feelings of worthlessness or excessive guilt. You have trouble thinking or concentrating or making decisions. And lastly, it can often be accompanied by recurrent thoughts of suicide or just thinking that life isn't worth living. And so if you feel like you have a majority of those symptoms, then really you should see a health or mental health professional. And if it persists, then they would diagnose you as having depression.
Now you mentioned in the book that there were some side effects that went along with that. Things like impulsiveness, mm-hmm. poor coping skills and such, addictions. So how do they factor into these ones above? They're subsets of them, are they?
Well, so that's the official criteria for the diagnosis of major depressive disorder.
Okay.
But one of the things that they call attention to in the book is that for an individual, we're knowing the neuroscience of it, there's a lot of overlap between the neural circuits that contribute to depression and the ones that control insomnia and anxiety and chronic pain and addiction. And often these disorders co-occur. So someone could have depression and social anxiety, or depression and an addiction. And often these disorders are contributing to each other. There's a great study that looked at people with insomnia. And this is another example of the downward spiral. The study followed people with insomnia and saw that if it was left untreated, they were much more likely to then develop depression. But it's also true that if you are depressed, then you often have trouble sleeping. You have problems with insomnia. So insomnia can lead to depression, and depression can lead to insomnia, and these symptoms become self-reinforcing in a way such that it becomes this stable state that's difficult to get out of. And that's That's why I call it a downward spiral. And the same can be true of having an addiction. The addiction causes slight changes in neural circuits that after, you know, you've finished drinking, you have a little bit of depressed mood, and then that depressed mood can make you want to self-medicate through drugs or alcohol, and then that again creates a downward spiral.
Yeah. So can you inherit depression?
In a sense. So what's interesting is a lot of people have views of depression or science that are very black and white, because we think of science as being an exact science, right? Because it's called science. But really, science looks at statistical probabilities, and that's generally what most complicated traits that you would inherit from your parents. That it's not necessarily something like hair color or eye color. It's a much more complicated genetic picture that is also complicated by your upbringing. So if you have parents with depression, then you're more likely than the average population to develop depression.
And that's because of the childhood experiences?
It's a combination of factors. It's a combination of the genetics, the genes, the DNA that you get from your parents, along with your childhood experiences. If your mother has postpartum depression, then probably, which means you're getting depressed after having birth, well, she probably has some genes that are increasing the risk of getting depression. You probably inherited some of those, and those genes are shaping the neural circuits and neurochemicals that control mood and activity. So that's part of it. But also, if you're being raised by someone who's depressed, then they might not be responding to you in an appropriately supportive emotional way. And that those early interactions in childhood actually shape and guide your brain development. So maybe even if you had certain genetics, but your mother had and your father had dealt with their depression such that they could interact with you and the world in a more powerful way, then your social interactions wouldn't trigger those genes. So you could be, in a sense, rescued from your genetic path, because genes are not destiny. Oftentimes they take an environmental, they require an environmental trigger to cause problems in your life. So yeah, certain genes are elevating your risk. But if you have a positive experience in childhood, then that can help create positive brain circuits. Whereas other people, maybe you don't have a lot of risk factors in your genes, but you go through some childhood trauma. Well, that can cause problems in the development of certain neural circuits as well. So the contributions to depression are numerous and wide-ranging, but they include the genes from your parents, your early childhood experiences, which are all shaping your brain development, and then depending on your current life circumstances, which includes your relationships and your job and your exercise level and your coping habits, these are all shaping and contributing to your brain activity and chemistry and susceptibility to depression.
How about anxiety and worry? That must contribute heavily.
Yes, anxiety and depression often co-occur in a lot of scientific measures of depression, where we're trying to just look at how much someone is getting better. There are a lot of measures of anxiety in there, and it can make depression worse sometimes depression can trigger anxiety, sometimes anxiety can trigger depression. Again, that's part of the downward spiral. And it's actually such an important part of depression that I had the whole second chapter of my book devoted to it. And I realized I hadn't done a good enough job of explaining the connection, because my editor wrote to me something like, the second chapter of your book seems to be about anxiety, but the book is supposed to be about depression, so I don't know if we can include that chapter. And I was like, whoops, I didn't do a good enough job in the first couple of sentences explaining the deep connection between depression and anxiety, because they rely on a lot of the same neural circuits.
Yeah, one of the things I liked about, in the book, in that chapter, was, we worry, and mm-hmm. but, you know, when we worry, we think about, well, what am I going to do about this? What am I going to do about that? What am I going to do about this? But then at other times, we plan. We say, okay, yeah. we're gonna plan to do something here. Well, when you worry, you're sort of planning, but they're really different. Why don't you explain the difference between the two?
Yeah, sure. It's planning and worrying actually rely on a lot of the same neural circuitry. Humans are blessed with this, with part of the brain called the prefrontal cortex, which is essentially the front third of your brain. And it's what allows you to examine the future and figure out where your choices might lead you. Just think of like a chess game. We can look at a chessboard and see, oh, I could move my pawn, but then he would take my knight, or I could move my queen there, but then my opponent would do this. And we can go through a whole series of potential consequences to our actions. And that's one of the things that allows humans to be so successful in doing such amazing things. But that neural circuitry also can have a downside, because if the emotional content or focus on the negative aspects of the future is turned up just a little too much, then we can get stuck in this paralysis of action where we see all the negative consequences, potential consequences of our actions. And we say, oh, I could move there. Oh, but then I could do that. Or I could do this. Oh, but then I couldn't do that. And then we get stuck in this loop of worry where we think about all the negative consequences, and all the negative consequences make us focus more on the negative. And then we don't lead to action. So nothing changes about it. And so we just are left to continue worrying. And it's really, unfortunately, just a consequence of all this planning circuitry that we have. And that's one of the interesting things about depression in the brain, is that a lot of these negative symptoms, like what we would think of as worrying, is not, no one wants to worry too much, but they are born out of capabilities that our brain has that are good for us. And so really, there's nothing inherently wrong with worry. It just means that you're thinking deeply about a problem. The only problem with worry is if it's combined with a lot of other traits, or the neural circuits that contribute to worry are interacting and overlapping too much with certain other neural circuits. Like, if you worry, but then you're decisive, well, okay, maybe you worry a little bit, but then you make a decision, you move on. The problem comes when you're worrying and indecisive, because then you can get caught in this loop where you don't move forward. Or if your worry triggers deeper anxiety, and then your anxiety triggers your worry, and then you're caught in this downward spiral.
Yeah. You say planning is thinking and worrying is emotion. And it's all right to have a little emotion in there, but if it controls the thinking process, then you get yourself in trouble.
Yeah. Interesting. I mean, there's a, thinking is just, it's just pure rational thought where we intend to make action, whereas worry is often becomes disconnected from action, and we're just focused on the emotional aspect of oh, I could do this, but then the negative emotional aspect of how that would make us feel or how it would make other people feel. And so if you sometimes calm your emotions down a little bit or start noticing how you are focusing only on the negative and try to force yourself to focus on positive outcomes or choose to move a little bit in one direction such that you're making an action, it actually limits the possibilities so that you have less to worry about. Or if you notice that your worrying is triggering anxiety, there are a bunch of different things you can do to manage that anxiety so the worrying doesn't get worse.
Yeah. We're talking with Dr. Alex Korb about depression, and we've talked about how to recognize it and the causes. Well, now let's talk about the upward spiral. Let's talk about getting out of depression.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, what's a good way to start?
Well, I think the easiest way to start is just utilizing exercise.
Okay.
And by exercise, I don't necessarily mean formal exercise, going to the gym 4 times a week. It just means moving a little bit more than you are now. Because if a lot of times people with depression, they're just sitting on the couch all day and or lying in bed a lot. If all you can manage is just getting up and walking outside to the sidewalk and then coming back inside, well, that extra movement and change in environment and exposure to sunlight, well, all those little aspects are contributing to you getting better. And if you start to feel a little bit better, well, maybe tomorrow you can go for a walk around the block. But I like exercise as a good place to start because it's conceptually very easy for everyone to understand.
Okay.
What I always forget this part because it seems obvious to me, which is that the simple awareness of the fact that you're experiencing this negative emotional state and that there are things you can do to change your brain activity and chemistry and mood and emotions for the better, that simple awareness is often the first key step, because a lot of people don't realize A, that something's wrong, or B, that they can do something about it. So hopefully people get that first step from our conversation.
Yeah. And, that's important in most everything that we're doing in life.
Right.
If we could just be aware of what's going on a little bit, then we can either say, hey, that's good, or most of the time it's, okay, I can improve that because
right.
I understand it. That's a big deal.
I'd like to add a little bit about exercise, because a lot of people, when they hear that, they roll their eyes. Because, oh, yeah, everyone said exercise. I know exercise is good for me. It's supposed to be good for my heart health, too, everything. But exercise, or even just moving more than not moving, has a lot of measurable beneficial effects on the brain. And I think sometimes when people start to realize that it's having a physical impact on your neural activity and chemistry, they can start to realize that, okay, even if they don't feel better immediately, they recognize that they are having a beneficial effect on their brain. It's like adding fertilizer to their brain. It's not necessarily you put fertilizer in the garden, your plants don't just spring up, but you're creating the conditions for improvement. So for some people, go for a run, oh, they'll feel immediately better. Other people, okay, it might take a few days, but you're going to start to reverse the course of depression, because it's going to have an impact on the serotonin system and the dopamine system and a whole bunch of other specific regions of the brain, like the prefrontal cortex, and it's going to reduce the stress response in the body and the brain, and it's going to improve the quality of your sleep so that it's more restful. And all of these little changes are contributing to further positive life changes being more accessible and easy to execute. And that's why I call it the upward spiral, because it's not like there's one big solution to depression. There's just a bunch of little small changes that you can make that start adding to more than the sum of their parts. And it can create a opposite force that's pushing you up out of the downward spiral of depression.
Yeah. Why don't you talk a little bit about the value of setting goals and making decisions?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's one thing that the prefrontal cortex is really good at. It's really the only part of our brain that cares about our values and our long-term decisions and our goals. The other parts of the brain are much more like those parts that control the actions, are very low level, often thought of as the reptilian part of the brain. And then we have another layer around that that's, we call the mammalian brain, which really deals with a lot of emotional responses. And the prefrontal cortex sort of is the most newly evolved part, and it sits and can control at the top and sort of can control these lower level processes. And so by setting a goal, you can actually sometimes modulate your emotional brain because you can make it more exciting to try and achieve something specific, or you can help manage your emotions, and you can rely on setting a specific goal is actually also going to, or having a certain intention actually changes the way your brain perceives the world. So we call this top-down processing, because we oftentimes think of the prefrontal cortex as the sort of top of the brain, as the more advanced part. And if you have a certain intention, you're like, okay, I'm planning to reach this goal, I'm planning to act in this way, it can actually go so far as to change your even visual perception of the world. There's a great experiment where people just were asked to do this simple task where they're either intending to point at something or intending to grab something. And based on what image was flashed in front of their head, it actually changed the activity in their visual cortex, which is a very low-level processing. The intention that they had changed how they actually perceived the objects in front of them. And so we can think of that on a larger scale as if you are moving through the world with a particular intention or goal in mind, it helps your brain sift through all of the millions of irrelevant stimuli that are coming into your brain at every second. And it starts to realize, oh, that's important. That's important. And those things get highlighted because they're relevant to your goal. But if you don't have a goal, or you allow yourself to get caught in this worry loop where you're not making decisions, then oftentimes you just get inundated with everything that's going on in the world, and the key factors don't pop out.
When I was in the business world, I used to always tell my employees, you need to make a decision. You can't fall in love with your decision, but you need to make a decision.
Yes.
And then monitor it. And if it's the wrong decision, turn around and go the other way. But you got to make a decision. You got to do something. And then you'll find out if it's right or wrong. But the indecision is never the right answer.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes it's good to take a few moments to think and plan about what you think might be a good decision. But you don't want to get stuck in that state for too long trying to make the best decision. And that's often where people get stuck, because a lot of times you don't have enough information right now to know what the best decision is. You just have to, so stop getting stuck there at that point. Make a decision in your head and then follow it up with action such that you start moving down a particular path. And as you are moving down that path, things will start to coalesce. Your brain will start to clarify different aspects of the world. You will gain new information and you will start to realize, oh, yes, this is the correct path. Or it's mostly the correct path, but I need to deviate. or this is completely the wrong path. But now, even if you have to go back and go a completely different direction, you are doing so with greater knowledge.
Exactly. The other thing you talk about is the importance of sleep. And you talk about sleep hygiene, which I'd mm-hmm. never thought about before.
Yeah.
What's sleep hygiene and how does that help you?
The sleep hygiene is a really interesting concept. I'd never heard of it until I started working in a sleep lab in college where we kept teenagers in the lab in underground basement for 3 weeks living on a 28-hour day. That was interesting. This little fascinating tidbit about my life. So sleep hygiene is a set of all your behaviors and the environment around sleep. And a lot of us don't realize how our environment or actions that precede sleep actually impact the quality of our sleep or how easy it is to fall asleep. And I think this is really important because sort of like exercise, people roll their eyes when they say, oh yeah, you need to get more sleep or improve your sleep. Because like, yeah, I'd love to get more sleep. I just don't have the time. And the great thing about sleep hygiene is that there's little changes you can make in what you're doing right before you go to sleep that actually improve the quality of your sleep so that even if you can't get more sleep, the sleep that you do get is more restful. And that includes simple things like not being in a brightly lit environment. Bright lights inhibit the brain's release of a substance called melatonin. And that chemical is essential to getting quality sleep. So if you dim the lights a little bit after the sun goes down, then it's going to help you fall asleep and get quality sleep. If you're lying in bed playing on your iPhone or writing emails, one, that's a problem with the light from your device shining right into your eyes. But two, you're activating your prefrontal cortex, you're planning, you're doing all of these things, and your brain really needs a little bit of time to wind down before it goes to sleep in order to get the most quality sleep.
How long does it need generally? I mean, if say you're watching television or working on a computer, how much time should you give yourself to before you turn out the light and say, okay, let's try to get some sleep here?
Well, it's different for different people, but I would say in general about 20 to 30 minutes.
Okay.
And different people have different sensitivities to that.
Right,
I mean,
right.
If you don't feel like you have any problems with the restfulness of your sleep, you feel up waking refreshed every day, okay, then maybe you're not having any problems. But it's just an area to look at. If you're having problems with depression or particularly any problem with sleep where you have difficulty falling asleep or you just feel like your sleep isn't that restful, well, then maybe turning off your computer 5 minutes before sleep isn't quite enough for you. Try pushing it back to 20 minutes or 30 minutes and then replacing all of that mental activity and work activity with things that are more conducive to sleep. We often talk about having a sleep routine where you just, okay, maybe you take a shower and you brush your teeth and you write in a gratitude journal or you say your prayers. Things that help your brain wind down, help you focus on the positive, and put you start putting your brain in a place where it will be ready to fall asleep easily.
Let me follow up on that. Your comment on gratitude in the book.
Yeah, I just put that right in there.
You did. You said that gratitude helps with depression. How is that?
Well, a lot of times people can dismiss gratitude as, that sounds so new agey. I mean, maybe your audience is more attuned to that because it is common sense spirituality. But it's gratitude is not just having an emotional effect where you are looking at the positive aspects of your life. It is also having a measurable effect on brain activity and chemistry. There was a great study that showed that thinking about the happiest moments in your life actually increased the production of the neurotransmitter serotonin in a region that helps mediate the communication between your thoughts and emotions. And so gratitude is helping break up the negative cycle that your brain has get stuck in depression. And oftentimes it's not the finding something that is that you're going to feel so grateful for. It's just remembering to look for things to be grateful for in the first place, because that's one of the problems with depression is that your brain keeps focusing on the negative, and the more you focus on the negative, the more it gets reinforced that you should be focusing on the negative. But if you can just have a little bit of input to the system where you remind yourself occasionally to start looking for the positive, then you can start to make it easier to see positive things in your life, or even that act of trying to look for things that are positive, even if you can't find them always, that intentional act can have beneficial emotional effects.
Yeah. And how about relying on others for assistance and help? How does that help us with that?
Well, there's a bunch of different ways that it can help. Humans evolved as social animals. We need other people in order to be happy. Now, that's for different people. They have differing needs. Some people can be alone in a room for 12 hours a day and be fine. Other people need a little bit more social interaction. And one of the keys is to recognize, okay, if you're feeling a little bit down, okay, this is one of the areas of your life that you should examine. There's nothing wrong with being a person who likes to be by themselves. There's nothing wrong with being a person who gains energy from other people. It's just recognizing what kind of person are you. So social interaction of talking with people, sometimes even if it's just random people, that can have a beneficial effect on our mood. Being able to talk about our emotions or just our lives in general with people close to us can have a beneficial effect. And then even other things such as physical interaction with other people can be important. For example, hugs or handshakes or touches, these have very specific neural effects in a chemical called oxytocin, which is a chemical that helps us feel bonded towards other people and close and connected. And it actually helps reduce stress and anxiety. And you can actually get it from a hug or a massage. And these things help your brain manage some other parts of your life. So a lot of times people think, okay, they have to do it all on their own, but relying on conversations with other people or physical interactions can be an important step to start changing that course of depression.
How can people find out about your book and buy your book and really anything that you're doing these days?
That I'm doing, yeah. Well, I have a website, alexkorbphd.com, and I have a blog on Psychology Today called Prefrontal Nudity, Your Brain Exposed. So you can search for my blog, but I'm reposting a lot of stuff on my website. My book is available, The Upward Spiral. You can find it on my website, but it's available on Amazon or anywhere books are sold. You can go to your library. Anything to get it out there, but hopefully it's easy to find.
Alex, thanks so much for being on the show with us. You've been a great guest, and I really appreciate you coming. Dr. Alex Korb.
Thanks for having me.
Obtaining wisdom is a long process, as no one can bestow it on us. The more we talk and hear each other's ideas, the more we'll be able to mature our own views. Questions and answers from the chat room for today's show and other shows will be posted on my website at davidgagan.com. You can ask other questions directly by going to the contact section of my website. I'll publish those answers as well. Also, I cover all these subjects and many more in my book, The Endless Journey. I look forward to sharing our thoughts every Friday morning at 9 a.m. United States Eastern Time here on W4CY.com. You can also find all the old episodes on iHeartRadio at iHeart.com. Truth is indeed stranger than fiction, and it turns out to be an amazingly good news story. We all have a great destiny ahead of us. Let me leave you with one last thought. You are a unique spirit having a life experience. You are far more important in the grander scheme of things than you can possibly realize. Enjoy your life. You've earned it.